I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. This is Thursday, February 26th, and it's a beautiful day. I love the snow. I know some people don't like to drive in it, which I really don't, but I live part of my life in Colorado and in the foothills of Colorado, so I guess it could be worse, let's put it that way. I would like to send a message out for the rest of the committee to please get here. And with that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 506.
Madam Chair, at the request of the Oregon Medical Association, there were four bills assigned to this committee, 506, 7, 8, and 9. The committee heard 509 last week on credentialing and silent PPOs. Today we'll hear 506, 507, and 508. 506 has to do with eligibility and coverage. Requires insurers to allow web-based or telephone access by provider to specify information regarding claims for reimbursement. Okay. Let's start with 506.
Dr. Lace.
Thank you very much, Chair Miles Anderson and committee members, or member. Thank you for allowing us to testify today. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association, and I'm also a practicing pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. And we're here, obviously, to testify in favor of Senate Bill 506. Briefly, it's an amendment to Oregon's current laws on prior authorization. And under current law, the health insurers are bound by prior authorization determined made within 30 days of the date of service provided. We'd like to reduce that down to basically 72 hours. And that means that you have to have a different system set up, and you have to have access basically online to be able to do this and not just have written. Many of the insurance companies are doing this. I know where their local managed care organization through MVIPA, they're online all the time, and so we can get things done very quickly.
With where?
With our local, I mean, just personally speaking, I can tell you what happens here in Salem.
Okay.
They're very electronic. We've been having electronic health records for 8 years now, so we're very, very deeply embedded with electronic data. So for us, this is easy, and so we like the concept of being able to do this in a much faster time frame. And if we have a procedure that we need authorization for, or we refer a patient for a procedure, then we want to make sure that eligibility process is speeded up and there's not a delay put in, especially for patient care issues. And this bill also provides for some penalties if they don't provide, you know, that access within, and so that's another change to the statute. We're going to have some other people coming up to testify. We've got legal counsel here to advise, to be available if there's some questions that on legal issues. I'll stop there.
All right. Well, we may have questions later, but let's have the next one on, which is Brian Parrott.
I'm actually a legal counsel for the OMA, so I'm going to sit back and wait. If you have questions later, I'd be glad to answer those.
Okay, so we have Dr. Jake. Mr. Jake.
Feeler.
Okay. And Marilyn Happel Latham?
No. I'm doing 507.
Oh, you signed up on 506. So that's not on my list, so if you're for 506, please come forward.
Jeff Baird.
Jeff
Baird. He didn't sign up for 506.
Okay, Jeff Baird.
Yes.
All right.
Chairperson Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for letting me testify today. My name is Jake Thielen. I'm the administrator of Orthopedic and Fracture Clinic in Portland, Oregon. It's a 14-physician musculoskeletal practice, and we deal with prior authorizations all the time. I've given you some written testimony. I don't really want to read, so waste your time with reading through that. But what we'd like to have done with this bill is to have some teeth in there for the insurance companies. when we prior authorize a surgery, when we verify that someone's eligible, that we think that should be a binding thing, that the insurance company should then be paying for that service rather than coming back after the fact and being able to deny that when we've gone through the time and effort to make sure that it's already handled, and the insurance company comes back and takes things out of our hands at a later date.
I'm Jeff Baird. I'm the administrator of Broadway Medical Clinic and here to testify as well. I appreciate the privilege of being here. We struggle on a daily basis with the insurance industry. We're a primary care practice up in Portland. And we've been there for 76 years, and it has never been worse to get care delivered to a patient and determine if you're going to get paid for it or not. We struggle on a daily basis with the insurance industry, who in all rights are trying to keep costs down, but in doing so, they're adding barrier after barrier to delay care. Senate Bill 506 is simple. It establishes a set of rules so we can effectively and irrevocably help determine if a patient's service for that day is going to be covered and paid for. As it is now, the insurance companies can approve something and then retract that eligibility or that approval retroactively. Our business is a little bit different than Jake's at the surgical at orthopedics. We set up the referral on the lead. We called the insurance company. We establish or send the progress notes to the specialist and get everything approved. So we're actually doing the same thing that they're doing on the front end of this. And it takes a tremendous amount of time, out-of-pocket costs for us, and we're still not sure if the patient is going to be able to receive the service on the date of the surgery. The eligibility that we're asking for, the changes allow for telephonic or web-based eligibility and confirmation. And that's a good first step. We'd also like to see the HIPAA the HIPAA eligibility transaction data set would be a good second step, but somehow we need to streamline this whole process.
Are you, how do you find out whether an OHP patient gets paid? Is that web-based at all?
It is web-based. We have two different methods, but we prefer the web-based method right now. We see about 400 patients a day. It takes about 2 minutes per patient to get online, log into the insurance's website, and determine eligibility. And if we were to do that for every patient, they'd be lined up down the hallway and out the street. And it's about 13, 14 hours just for the patients that we see just to check the web eligibility. It's still better than not having it, but the eligibility is there for OHP. It's there for about half of the insurance companies that we see, ranging from okay to really bad access. There's nothing that really works really well, really streamlined this fast. But each time a different patient comes to check in, they have to log on to that website for that insurance company, go through the process, you know, the passwords, you know, type in the patient's eligibility information and just find out if that's correct insurance. But it still does not guarantee patients or guarantee payment. You know, they have quite a bit of time of retroactive revocation of that.
So you could access the web, mm-hmm. and then find out late and you see that the patient is covered, mm-hmm. and then later they come to, and maybe you get paid, maybe you don't, but right. then they come back later and say, oh, this patient isn't covered. That's basically what you're saying.
Exactly. Okay. So just having the web access is good. It's a good start. Being able to do it in bulk, ideally, we should be able to take tomorrow's schedule or next week's schedule, shoot it off to a clearinghouse, have it processed, and have coverage and eligibility information sent back to us that will stick, that will, you know, that will be binding to that relation or to that service that we're providing. We can't do that right now.
Representative Schaffler, and then we'll...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be very brief. Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. I submitted these bills on behalf of our friend Tim Martinez from OMA. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an insurance person. I'm far from an expert. I've just learned a lot about this stuff just listening to these guys to my right. But one thing I am is a legislator, and over the years that I've been here serving with you good people, I've found that if you get a bunch of people in the room together, I think maybe they can work it all out, and that's what I told Mr. Martinez. I've come and request that you do, Madam Chair. Some examples, clearly sensitive issues like prevailing wage, cancer presumption, request of public information. We have Safe and Liberty, who came to my committee, Business and Labor, our agreement on a bill that they've been arguing over the subject matter for years, since I've been here. The court recording fee is another example where affordable housing people and home builders and the bankers and the realtors all agreed on something. It's almost miraculous the amount of cooperation I've seen. Hopefully we'll get the farmers and the good people that provide us with aggregate to come to the same agreement, some kind of agreement this session, too. I'm an expert, somewhat of an expert in gravel. Nothing is good, close to Senator Morris, but so that's pretty much why I'm here today, just to you and your wisdom, I know we'll do the right thing, but I think if you rounded all these nice folks up and got them in the same room and said, how can we hammer this out, I'm confident this committee can make something work. That's why I'm here. I'm not a doctor. I'm married to a dentist. That's as close as I can get to the medical field. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
All right. Senator Veitch.
I won't ask Representative Schaffer any questions on this issue.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
I may need his vote someday. And
That's probably a good chance.
Thank you, Representative Schaffer.
I think this really illustrates not only a problem for providers but insurers and sort of the dysfunctional system we have. In my office, like any other office, we're constantly on the phone. I've got an MA, or medical assistant, spends most of her time calling insurances to find out if a drug has to be pre-authorized, calling to confirm that that patient has that insurance, the insurance hasn't changed, that the benefit hasn't changed. Do we have to get a prior authorization to make a referral to a specialist? Do we have to get a prior authorization for certain imaging services? And the list goes on and on and on. We actually have forms we use just for doing this. And then once we get those, occasionally, not very often, but occasionally, we'll get it authorized. The procedure will be performed, referral will be made, the drug will be ordered, the MRI or CT scan will be done, and the patient, 2 months later, 3 months later, in their explanation of benefits, the famous EOB, gets a denial on it, and then the patient comes back to us extremely angry that they've been billed for something that we should have taken care of with their insurance company. We need a better way of dealing with this. Mm-hmm. And I think Representative Schaffer was right on. As I read all three of these bills last night, I went, aha, aha, and aha. These are exactly what we should work on. So I'm glad we're dealing with these today and having testimony on them. But I think Representative Schaffer is correct. Probably need to sit down at the OMA and the insurers, sit down and look at these bills a little more carefully and come to an agreement very quickly, in 2 or 3 weeks, get back to us with some language that everyone agrees to. But I would still like to hear full testimony. I want to hear the whole story on
right.
this.
All right. With that, those were the proponents. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here. And now we will go to Dave Fiskum and Mike Dewey.
Dave is not here.
Okay, well, Dave Fiskum is not here. But I know Lisa Trussell is here and Kim, Mike, is it Wentz or Mike?
Wirt. Thank you, Mike Dewey, representing the ODS companies. I will be brief. I recall sitting over at CDBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, a number of years ago, negotiating the prompt pay legislation that the OMA produced. And I think we ended up with a good product.
Okay, whoever's phone is going off, please turn it off.
Sorry.
She said, that's my phone, and I said, oh, I'm sorry. Anyway, I said that we had
on behalf of ODS, myself and others participated in a work group, and we're happy to do this. We think Senate Bill 506 is flawed for a number of reasons. The 72 hours just doesn't work. We don't know if it's calendar business, but it just doesn't work. We think the 30 days we have works just fine. We have a medical doctor at the table here, so we're in front of me, and so I would say there are going to be issues from time to time. This is very complicated. I did find it intriguing that we have all the ability to provide with regard to the negotiations, and the doctors don't. We don't feel that way with hospitals, so it's a complicated world. But we think this bill needs a lot of work. The civil penalties are onerous from our perspective, in the sense that we're not sure how many there might be in terms of if there was a potential judgment in terms of violations, 3, 4, 5, depending on how a form was filled out. So we think the bill is very problematic, needs a lot of work, and we will participate if that's the will of the chair. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Chair Melissa Anderson, committee. My name is Kim Wirtz, and I'm with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Regents also has problems with the current language within the bill, and the position that we've got, we completely understand the struggle that we go through in dealing with consumers and patients on the provider's side in the collection of the collection for the services that are rendered. However, everything that we do at Regents has to do with what's best for our members. We do believe that the binding pre-authorization provisions that we're currently bound to are appropriate. We try to minimize the number of those that are required for services that might be questionable. The problem that we've got with the language having to do with eligibility has to do more with the operational issues that we don't always know whether or not the small business owner, the large business owner, or the consumer is using the grace period allowed under their premium payment to help with their financial situation. If we don't get a premium payment and they're in the grace period of the policy, we can't suggest to anyone that that coverage is not in force. Yet we don't know until that grace period expires whether or not that premium is going to come in. And I think that's one of the most troublesome pieces that we see with this. We recognize the problems this causes, but we do have to protect the patients by allowing those grace periods so that they can pay their premiums within the time periods. Those consumer protections are very, very important to us. We do believe that having adequate communication available to any provider in their office based on what their needs are is important, and we do provide a lot of these tools from a region's perspective for our provider community so that they have access both to web-based and live customer help on a regular basis. We, too, would work with any group you put together to see what we could do to help amend this to a position that we could not oppose.
I could understand when some individuals are late in paying their premiums, but I would think that a majority of them, but maybe not, are employer-based, so that those patients shouldn't be a problem.
Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee, that would be true, except that we're in a situation where employers are collecting a portion of the premium from their employees' payroll, and they may not do a monthly payroll. Employers are also using their grace periods with regards to making their premium payments. We don't necessarily get those premiums on the first day of the month, and actually it's heavily used because they know there's no penalty.
Do you actually have data that could show us what percentage of individuals or businesses pay on time and you don't have a problem, and what
I would imagine we
it would be
some
interesting
data about
to
what
see
our delinquency. We have a rather large staff that deal with that on a regular basis because there's a number of notifications that are also required as a result of the delinquency process. So, yes, I'd be happy to go back and take a look at data.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes.
This delinquency problem, is it a growing problem with the economy going the direction it is right now, or is it this a sort of a steady-state problem you've always had?
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Bates, I think delinquency has always been an issue with Regents. Because of the way the grace periods for premium payment are applied, the insurance bill is typically the last one that gets paid. They know that they can stretch it right to the very last day and that we're going to do everything that we can to keep them as a member or a member firm. And as I understand, as some of the prompt payment bills came through several years ago, that this was actually a discussion that a lot of carriers had on a national basis, so it's not unique to Oregon. I think with the current economic system situation that we will see more of it. Additionally, there are people who just allow their coverage to lapse by allowing the grace period to run out, and those are typically the situations that we don't know about until the end of the grace period.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I think you've actually answered my next question. If it's a delinquency that ultimately gets paid, it gets paid a week, 2 weeks late, the money still rolls in, and you may have a cash flow problem because of it, but it comes in. The real problem, I would guess, and you can tell me this is not correct, they use their grace period, but the payment never comes. You have to drop them as their carrier, and the patient during that time has a service done. And now the patient's caught out in the open. They didn't know that the money they gave their employer for match money and the money the employer is supposed to put in didn't go into the policy. You're saying you weren't covered during that time. The money never came in. And at the same time, they got something done. And
that's
now
right.
We're all caught in this trap.
Right.
Okay. I would expect that maybe some of the discussion you'll be having is how you deal with that grace period. And maybe even saying, we have not received that payment. You may or may not be insured this month. And the way electronics work these days, hopefully you can get a fast answer on that. No, you can't always. But that's part of the discussion, I assume.
I think that's true, yes.
And you tighten that up. And then, and the employee might go to the employer and say, how come you didn't make the payment? I just checked. I may not be covered right now.
That's correct. But on the web, though, couldn't you put paid through month by month? I mean, so that the physicians would know? I mean, I would think that you have that information. You know that they're paid month to month. And if you had some statement somewhere that said paid through, and that way they could pick it up right away and physicians would know the grace period. I don't know. Changing software,
yeah.
I know is expensive, yeah. But
I think that is a part of the discussion that needs to take place, is just exactly how much information can we offer without causing our customers to feel like we're not, that we're maybe, I don't know, referring to them as a deadbeat for not paying the premium. I mean, that's another situation we certainly don't want to get into.
I think that in this particular case is necessary. If they want coverage, they need to pay their premiums. So,
Chairman Sanderson, we do agree with you.
But another little piece of information I would like also is just in the last 6 months, have you seen a decrease in enrollment or increase in enrollment for your policyholders?
Chairman Sanderson, I would have to go back and get some specifics.
Yeah.
I think
I'd
things
like that
are slowing down.
Too.
I would suggest things are slowing down. We might not be seeing as many new, but again, I would need to go back and provide you the data.
Okay.
We'd be happy to provide the same data.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding the website, I mean, still we think that 72 hours is problematic. We're happy to talk about the discussion of what that might be.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell. Oh, Senator Morris, sorry.
Well, excuse me. I was just going to offer a reply to your question. In a hospital board meeting last night, the self-pays are exploding. And we're looking at 10% of net revenue that's uncompensated. It's exploding right now.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plans, and we're also opposed to Senate Bill 506 for reasons that have already been stated, but also because
You heard a week or two ago about a group that had been pulled together by the Oregon Business Council and others to look at health care costs and to try and contain health care costs. And one of the subgroups is the Administrative Simplification Group, and it's got carriers, hospitals, doctors on those work groups. And some of the issues that have been described about trying to have good eligibility information is one of the issues they're addressing. And they have a work plan that they're looking at. It doesn't address the 72 hours. And it's my understanding when I was talking to our folks about this bill, this would actually shorten the time for doctors because I believe we currently give them 5 days. So if they want to pass this, and then that would reduce what we already have in place for them. And then we do have the standard 30 days on the benefits piece. So it's we appreciated the fact that the OMA came to us with their proposals, but particularly this one is being addressed in a work group that we're all trying to do some simplification issues, look at the fact there's a problem with so many different, with all of us having our own logins, so the doctors have to have multiple logins. That was a big issue that was identified that is on the work plan. Benefit cards and what the information contained on the benefit card to try and get more standardized. In our case, we have a bigger card. It folds in half to make the size of a regular card, but you have to open it up. So there's different size cards, different information. Those things have been identified. And I don't see in the minutes anywhere where they actually talked about the non-payment issue, but that's something that could easily be addressed perhaps through this bill. But for the others, we just feel that this work group that's what the purpose of the work group is that we're all participating on, and we're rather surprised to see that the bills were introduced. Oh, may I add one thing? I do know that our membership has decreased from, but I don't have the percentages or the numbers, but I know that, and it's in response to the economic conditions where either the businesses are closing or they just can't afford to offer the coverage anymore.
Okay. Any questions for this panel?
Well, just a comment. You know, sometimes our job here is to kind of spur people along. This has been a problem for 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, I guess. At least I know it for 30 years, and it's time to start fixing these things. The cost to the overall healthcare system is just too much money. It's too much administrative work, and with modern technology, we should be able to get through this. But we need people to come together to talk.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, Dave Fiskin.
I was right behind you.
Oh, yeah, got my back.
Madam Chair, committee members, I apologize for being out of the room testifying another next door on a different bill. For the record, Dave Fiske, I'm here this morning representing United Healthcare, one of our firm's clients. I really just want to say, in light of what I've heard in the last 10 minutes, me too, us too, and part of me says that we're surprised to see all these bills here. We would rather engage in a collaborative discussion about how to fix such issues as dealt with in Senate Bill 506, as well as when you hear 507 and 508, as well as 509. We think there's discussions that can occur that would solve these problems in a collaborative fashion. There's a shared responsibility here among employers, providers, carriers. So in a way, we're concerned that this bill is before you. We'd rather have the discussions and solve problems, and I wish OMA would have come to us in that spirit and we could have tried to solve these problems. So substantively, I will leave it there, Madam Chair, in light of your schedule this morning. United will submit to you a letter conveying its position on all three of these new bills, and we'd be pleased to participate in any work groups you set up on this bill as well as the one we're already there on 509. And there was a meeting yesterday on that subject, the bill that was before you a week ago or so. So I think with that, I'll stop and try to answer questions.
Well, if there's a group already working on it, then it really should be pretty expeditious in order to maybe come to some collaboration, maybe.
Madam Chair, I would only add that the Senate Bill 509 work group was yesterday at 12:30, and I was not in that room at that time, so I believe Ms. Dresser could probably update you on whether agreement was reached. I believe it was not reached yesterday.
Oh, I meant regarding this issue on 506.
We'd be pleased to talk about any of these issues with the OMA, and in some ways I would have hoped that those discussions could have occurred before a bill was introduced, but that's a personal comment from mine. From me, United Healthcare stands ready to deal with this, and on this issue, we believe the issues associated that are embedded in 506 are a shared responsibility among employers, providers, and carriers, and if we work together, we can solve these problems to make the system we're talking about here in 506 more effective for all concerned. Without the need for, if I can say so, legislation, I would share Mr. Dewey's comment that the penalties specified in this bill strike us as being very excessive. Our goal is to avoid penalties, and so perhaps that becomes moot if we avoid penalties because of our good, solid behavior or our collaborative style. But again, when penalties are proposed, that creates a different kind of dynamic than I think is helped by collaborative discussions on how to do the Senate Bill 506 processes more effectively.
All right. Okay, Courtney Dresser.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Courtney Dresser, representing the Oregon Medical Association, and before we move on, I thought we should just clarify a couple of things that for all of the bills, we did meet with all of the insurance companies and provided them all of our LC drafts and had meetings with almost every single one of them. I can provide the dates and times and who those were with for the committee and for obviously the folks in the room who weren't aware that their client met with us. So I apologize if they were not aware of that, but we did meet with them. We got some great feedback from them on all of our bills and provided, and there are some changes, especially to the next one, because of those meetings. Also, in regards to the Administrative Simplification Task Force, there are providers part of that task force, that subcommittee. It is a voluntary effort. The work plan doesn't have any solution or any type of, the work plan draft doesn't have, time frame doesn't have any solutions coming out until July or later. So again, I think what we're talking about is trying to kind of spur ahead and get things moving. We want that process to continue because there's a lot of things that this bill doesn't address regarding administrative simplification, so we hope it continues, but we do think that there's some things that we can do now. And again, we do hope to get together and try to come up with as many consensuses as we can. I'm sure not everyone's going to be happy, but hopefully we can still move forward on these bills. But I just wanted to state that we did meet with all of the, almost every single group.
Okay. Is there any questions for her? Yes, Senator Cruz.
No question, but just kind of a general statement because I am co-sponsor of these three bills plus 509, and I chose to do that with you, Madam Chair, not because I'm married to the bill in any way, shape, or form. What I'm married to is the fact that we have problems that need to be dealt with, and unfortunately, I think this may be the best way to get at them. At the end of the day, Madam Chair, if none of these bills prove to be necessary, if agreements can be reached, I'm one happy boy. So, but we've done that so many times in my time in this building, propose legislation, and then the parties go out and reach agreement, and the legislation disappears. And I think, personally, that's the best solution. But sometimes it takes a driver to make the discussions happen. That's my reason. The reason for my involvement as sponsor of these bills is the discussion needs to happen.
So, Courtney, I would like you to work with Mr. Shook in getting a work group together. I would like those who testified today that if you need to be a part of that, or want to be a part of that work group, would you please let Mr. Shook know and or Courtney know. I'm not sure which is the best way to organize this, but I would like to have amendments need to come soon, and hopefully at least this one particular issue you can somewhat address. And there may be some things that the payers just can't swallow, but then this is a process, and hopefully we'll be able to come up with addressing some of the problems that we have at the provider level. Okay?
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on 506, and I will open a public hearing on 507, and we'll...
Madam Chair, 507...
Dr. Lace?
...requires health insurers to make a decision on a participating provider application for membership within 30 days of receiving the application.
Okay, Dr. Lace, and then, all right.
Chair Miles Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Lace, and I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, the chairman of the Oregon Legislative Committee for the American Association. When we get a new physician license like we just have in our office, we have to go through a whole procedure to get our first year license done by the Oregon Medical Board, and then we have to get them credentialed to work in the office and get paid by the insurance companies. You have to get credentialed to actually work in the hospital and have people covered for this. There is always a bit of a time constraint, and lately, in the last, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 years, the credentialing process has just gone beyond what seems reasonable. And we realize that we don't want to have physicians here are going to cause harm. But if they've gone through the Oregon Medical Board and they've been licensed and there's nothing in the database that suggests that there's going to, you know, there's going to be a bad doctor, that we would like to speed up the credentialing process and get that physician paid. If you want to know what we really do in real life, I can tell you. If you don't want to hear that, then I won't tell you. So, but what this does is that it reduces us down, you know, to a shorter time frame. And we've already made one amendment here in the credentialing process. We moved it up. We thought 30 days, but we moved it up to 60 days to speed that up. And there's some other changes that you have in front of you. You know, what is defined as a completed application, better clarification on the credentialing process when it begins, and clarification on retroactive payments. So again, this is a way to hopefully reorganize things a little bit, speed things up a little bit, realizing that we don't want to put into the workforce doctors who are going to cause harm to people, but we would like to get the credentialing process speeded up. This one's a little more complicated. Language-wise, but that's the basic essence of it. We're going through this right now in our office if you want to know exactly what really happened. So.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, how long does it take to get credentialed through the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners?
From start to finish?
Yes, if you're...
Probably, if you actually have, if the licensee is actually doing a residency in the state, it's actually very quick because they've already got a limited license. And so that process can be speeded up and they've completed their residency. If they come from out of state, like our last new doctor that we just hired, it can take up to 3 months or sometimes a little bit longer. It just depends on what the background information is and what's going into that process.
Can you move the microphone closer to your...
All right. So it probably a safe number would be 3 months, you know, for the Oregon Medical Board to review a thing, and they have to go review the case. They have to meet as a board and determine, you know, the pastures of that. So I think three months. I could get you better information on that from the Oregon Medical Board, but I'd say a rough estimate. Our last actor was 3 months.
Follow up, I'm sure. Then once a physician is... board certified or certified
by the Oregon Medical
by the Oregon
yes.
Medical Board. What is there left to do for the insurance companies?
Well, the insurance companies have to review the case too. The hospitals have to review the case, and oftentimes you can't get the insurance companies to certify the doctor until the hospitals have gone through the certification process. The hospitals won't start the clock ticking until they actually have a licensee. So you can have a temporary, you can apply, but they're not going to do anything until you actually have your license, until you've been vetted, so to speak, you know, by the Oregon Medical Board. So they got to wait till that happens, and then we have another block of time to wait until the new doctor actually gets certified, you know, by the or credentialed by the hospital and then by the insurance companies. That whole time we've may have signed a contract saying, you know, we're going to hire you as of this date, and they show up thinking, hey, I got a license, but can't work, or I don't get paid, or whatever. But we have ways of dealing with that. You probably don't want to hear, but
I
can imagine.
but nonetheless, it's an issue about it's credentialing. So all we're trying to do is expedite that and make it a little more reasonable and more time friendly to the physician.
Well, thank you. Let me ask the question a little bit further. Once the certification and the credentialing is done, then what is there left for the insurance companies to do?
They have to credential the provider also. I mean, they have to say that, okay, they have to get all that background information. I don't know what actually happens on their end. There's usually a time delay. It's not just snap your fingers and they're automatically credentialed down there, so they can't.
Well, Madam Chair and Doctor, those are two very rigorous processes.
Yes.
I just question, what is there left to do once the
Tell us why it's necessary.
Well, they want to be careful. They want to make sure that their clients and the people that are buying their insurance plans are, you know, having good providers, and I understand that completely. But you've gone through two rigorous, you know, procedures already. So, but
yeah, something isn't adding up here. So,
do other states do it this way also? Is this nationwide?
I don't know. I suspect that they do, but I don't have background information.
Madam Chairman, I could offer a little more information, and others may disagree with them and say, generally speaking, in recruiting a new physician and getting him set up both with a hospital, with our getting him licensed to the state, set up the hospital, and set up with insurers, we allow 6 months.
6 months. That's what
it's 6 months. And you go through a credentialing first with the state. The word is not credentialing, it's getting your license in the state, which is a very rigorous process in the state with a lot of information required. Once information gets to the board, it's usually about a 45-day process to get it through. They're trying to work on getting it. They want to get down to 1 week once they've got everything in, and the stuff that has to come in is a lot. Where did your residency, letter of recommendation, where you've practiced before, have you had medical malpractice issues in the past? The board's very anxious about this because there's been some problems in the past, and they've really tightened things up, and I think they're doing the right thing. I really support the board being really tough in this state now, and so that's a good process. Then you go through the same process which each hospital you might be serving in. Usually most people are being certified at two different hospitals in big cities. Medford is two. Here it's one. But you get credentialed to both those hospitals. We usually have a common process. Now it's separate again. So you go through those two. So you can have privileges at both hospitals. And at the same time, you try to get through the insurance companies. But they're kind of in the position that they want to see that you've been vetted by these other organizations first. If you've got an organization that will get you through all your insurers at one shot, IPAs often do that, individual practice associations, that's good. But if you're doing individually, you might have 30 or 40 insurance companies you have to go through each one with. And you'll get through one, but the other one's delayed. It's just a mishmash. And I assume probably here in Salem you have an IPA that gets you through all the credentials at one time, more than likely. But it's a mishmash, and it's amazing what you have to go through to get all this done. And everyone's trying to protect themselves. Hospitals don't want a problem, the board doesn't want a problem, and the insurance companies don't want a problem. I think I would like to hear from the insurers what their position is on shortening that time period after the other two issues have been taken up. I've always been kind of incredulous that we have to go through the third one with the insurers. But
we'll find out.
I want to hear their side of the story.
How many that they've turned down, that the board has turned down, or if they've turned down any after they've gone through this other rigorous process. That'll be information that I'd like to know.
The ultimate result of all this is that we want, you know, good practicing physicians in the state. We want to make sure that the patients are cared for. So, I mean, we all understand the process. It's just kind of, we can streamline it a bit. So.
Okay. Great. Well, let's have Marilyn Heppel Latham and Jeff Baird.
Baird.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to come today. I've submitted a one-page testimony that I'll paraphrase, and also I provided or brought a copy of the Oregon credentialing packet, just for reference.
And reintroduce yourself for the record.
Oh, sorry, Jeff Baird, Broadway Medical Clinic. I think Marilyn and I both participate in the simplification committee that is a joint venture with the payers, hospitals, on all of these Senate bills that we've been talking about. And it is an ongoing process, but it's not moving very fast. And we would like to continue to work on that angle. Our clinic has been around for quite a while, 76 years, and we don't often have to credential a new physician because they usually come in and they retire in our practice. So we don't have to do this very often, but when we do, it's an absolute nightmare. The easy part is getting the medical license put in place, and for us, that's never a problem. For Lucky, it's an in-state physician that already has one. The real problem is when we go to credential with the health plans, and that's where the huge delays can occur. Jake with Orthofracture Clinic in Portland told me that they have a physician that has been in that credentialing phase now for 8 months with one of the plans. There's just no reason for that. Is credentialing necessary? Absolutely. I think it's important that we make sure that the physicians in practice are who they say they are and can do what we expect them to do. Is the redundancy necessary? Absolutely not. Unfortunately, I think the insurance companies are kind of stuck here. They have some requirements with JCHO that require something they call primary source investigation. But every single plan is doing primary source investigation when the state board has already done that. Also, CMS has already done that if the physician has been through the Medicare process. So the redundancy, I don't think, is necessary. Should this credentialing process delay that physician from practicing medicine in Oregon? And that's the big point here. I don't think it should. If the physician has submitted or has a license to practice in the state, and possibly even one other primary source investigation credentialing like CMS, I don't think there's a need for that physician to not be able to practice medicine or practice medicine and get paid for it. And that's the main purpose of this bill. If an application for credentialing is submitted completely, a clean application, during that credentialing process, whether it's 30, 60, or 90 days at the most, hopefully, we should be able to hold those billings, see the patients, and then submit them after the process. We're willing to take that risk. But what we're not willing to do, what I don't think is appropriate for the community with the shortage of physicians, is to let that physician sit idly by and not practice medicine. They're really lousy at filing medical records, and they get angry when we have them do that.
Hi, my name is Marilyn Happold-Latham. I'd like to thank you for letting me come and testify today. I'm currently working as a medical group consultant, and I've been working in the healthcare industry for a number of years, and most of that as a medical group administrator. I'm semi-retired at the current time as well. And I have submitted a page and a half of written testimony regarding this Senate Bill 507. I'd like to say that I'm supportive of the bill that would allow physicians to be paid during the credentialing process, because I don't think that physicians and patients should be penalized for the health plan's slow administrative functions. Process of physician credentialing by health plans is time-consuming, it's redundant, and it's an expensive process for both physicians and non-physician providers. The lengthy amount of time it takes most health plans to complete their credentialing process, which can be from 60 to 120 days, often results in health plans making it difficult for their patients to access medical care. Physicians avoid seeing patients with health plans they're not yet credentialed with because they know if they do, they won't be paid for their services. When the patient calls the office to make an appointment, they're told that the doctor can't see them. I consider the process time-consuming based on my recent experience working with a physician who's leaving a large medical practice to become a solo practitioner. And in order for him to continue to provide services for the patients that are already his established patients, he has to go through the credentialing process with all of the health plans. If this process is not completed, the physician will not be able to be reimbursed by the health plans for providing care to the patients of those plans. With nearly 20 plans that need to be credentialed that a physician needs to be credentialed with in Oregon's metropolitan areas, the process requires someone with knowledge to even know where and how to start the process. The process itself requires constant follow-up by the physician's representative in order to make sure that the health plans are keeping the process moving forward and that credentialing will be completed as quickly as possible. For the solo practitioner that I'm working with, this process will take almost 75 hours of time for a single physician. I consider the process redundant because, as we've talked about here before, the thorough process a physician has to complete in order to be licensed to practice medicine in the state of Oregon. There's practically no additional information provided to the health plans for their credentialing process that the physician has not already provided to the state in order to practice medicine. I consider this process to be expensive because of the amount of time it takes to complete it, as well as what can happen in the 60 to 120 day time period when the physician is not yet credentialed. Most large physician practices have one or more full-time equivalent staff that work on the credentialing process. It takes a skilled person to initiate and provide constant follow-up to get the process completed. For a small practice or solo practitioner without the resources of staff, they often have to rely on outside consultants to assist them with the process. I estimate the amount of time it will take to get through the process for the one physician I'm working with to cost him nearly $10,000. If a physician provides services to a health plan's patients in good faith during the 60 to 120 day time period, they may find their claim for payment has been denied because the credentialing process has not yet been completed. The physician usually has a choice of either billing the patient for the services provided, but most physicians, rather than making the patient angry, will merely write off the charges as bad debt. In large clinics with a number of new doctors at any given time, this can add up to thousands and thousands of dollars in lost revenue, while the health plans take no responsibility for the time it takes for the credentialing process to be completed. The health plans have practically no incentive to complete the credentialing process any faster than they do now. The incentive they have for not completing it any faster is that there's a very high likelihood that services will be provided to their health plan patients while the physician is still in the credentialing process. This gives them the ability to deny payment for services provided to the health plan's patients by the physician in good faith. These are payments that would have been made to the physician if she or he had already completed the credentialing process. Requiring health plans to pay for services provided to patients during this credentialing period, as Senate Bill 507 would make the lengthy credentialing process less burdensome on the physician and go a long way in eliminating frustrations physicians have with the health plans regarding this issue.
So interesting.
Welcome to my world.
All right. Is there anyone else that wants to testify for? Yes. Mr. Parrott.
Chair Moses, I just want to touch base very quickly. I know the
introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Ryan Parrott. I'm an attorney with Cooney and Crew and outside counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. I just wanted to touch base quickly. The committee has been given a copy of some amendments that were drafted. They were drafted earlier this week. I don't believe the insurance companies have yet seen a copy of them, so they may be. We've been talking about a 60-day period. The original was 30-day period. We've also made some changes that would require retroactive payments, which some of the witnesses testified about. Again, I don't know if the insurance companies have seen that, so that may have caught them by surprise. We've also added to it some information that requires what information must be included in a credentialing application: proof of a valid license, proof of a DEA certification, proof of a medical liability policy, and evidence of another primary source verification. Again, the idea we're trying to get to, and one of the things we learned when we met with the insurance companies, was that they do have requirements that they have to go through because of JACHO or NCQA. We're trying to show that those requirements have already been met, and hopefully we can give them the information they need to cut their time frame down as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions? All right. Let's have the payers come up. Dave Siskin, Lisa Trussell, Mike Dewey, Kim Wintz. And you can be two at a time. You don't all need to come up.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plans,
and here in opposition to Senate Bill 507. A lot of the concerns that were expressed by the proponents have also been identified in the Healthcare Leadership Task Force Subcommittee on Credentialing. And I noticed that what they're looking at in their work plan is to use an existing system that all the carriers could look at, such as the Council for Affordable Healthcare Quality. And also, they have been contacted by the Washington Healthcare Forum to perhaps look at a regional credentialing process. One thing is that you can reject an application fairly quickly because based on type of service, if you already have enough providers of a certain type in your panel. And so that can be done fairly quickly, say no. The other thing, issue I would raise, and I'd have to get back to my experts at the office on this, but we have most of the plans we sell are you have a preferred provider or you have an out-of-network. And so I would think that it's not that they wouldn't get paid. They would get paid as a non-PAR provider, one that we haven't an agreement with. So I have to go back and check on that. I'm not aware that we have said we do sell an HMO product, so that might be different. But if it's the bulk of our members are on a PPO arrangement, preferred provider organization, so I think that the providers would get paid if it's a covered service, but they'd get paid at the out-of-network rate as opposed to the in-network. And with that, I'd conclude my comments.
And on this web that I think is a great idea, can you list whether a particular physician is on a health plan? I guess
yes.
The health plans already know that, though, in their own
Chair,
practice.
Madam Chair, we have the list, and they change frequently, and they're updated. We used to print books, but they changed too quickly. By the time you got it printed and stapled, there was a difference. So the members can access through the website who's a covered provider.
With each health plan?
I would assume so, but I believe that's true. But I wouldn't speak for the others that aren't here because
okay.
I'm not positive.
Because I think that's very confusing for the patient also, having been a patient and trying to figure out which physician, when my physician...
Madam Chair, that's true when they retire, but typically most of them when they come in have a doctor already, so they're just looking to see if that doctor is on the panel or not.
You know how many Medicare people call me saying they can't find a provider?
Oh, I understand that. That's a whole different subject.
I know.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kim Wirtz with Regents of the Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'll keep my comments very brief. We, too, are participating in the Health Leadership Task Force group and appreciate that every process has room for improvement, and we continue to work with that group and would support a lot of the changes that they're talking about, recommending, talking about common funding to support the administrative expense of building some of these new systems.
Madam Chair, good morning again. Committee members, Dave Fiske, I'm here for United Healthcare. United has concerns with the proposed 30-day timeline. If there is an amendment that would make that 60, Mr. Parrott has said we haven't seen that yet, and he's right, we haven't, and we'll see that at some point. We recognize there may be outlier situations that cause credentialing to take longer than the average time. We don't believe legislation is necessary to dictate a specific time frame. Sometimes I also have my own confusions between the words credentialing and contracting, because in many cases what the health plans are doing is deciding who to contract with relative to the provider panel to serve the policyholders for a particular health insurer, in this case United. We believe flexibility should be given to accommodate individual and specific variables in this process. We don't want to rush it, or we don't want to cut corners. We're not sure legislation is necessary, but in many other states, and United is in 14 or 15 states around the country in terms of where it practices perhaps more, similar legislation does allow for 90 days to approve or reject a provider application. We also have been, suggest adding, if we move on this bill in some way, shape, or form, safe harbor language that allows for exceptions to the timeline for specific circumstances that are beyond a health insurer's control or influence. For example, not being able to schedule a site visit as required by NCQA for certain specialties, or allowing time for us to verify records that might exist from foreign medical schools. Third, we think the bill should clearly state that the credentialing process, the timeline, whatever it is, should not start until the health insurer has received a complete and accurate provider application, because sometimes there are delays in the submission of complete information. And then, to the extent that we move on this bill, we would have concerns about an emergency clause in it for immediate implementation. We think there ought to be a little time granted for the accommodation of whatever is drafted finally in this bill. And again, if there's a process to look at this, we'd be pleased to be part of that.
I understand the credentialing process and with the PPOs, but still, and that would be a reason not to credential, is that correct? If you had too many of a certain doctor on a panel and you did not want to cover another GP, which is ludicrous, but you would. All right. Why have you, except for that reason, have you denied credentialing? Have you denied credentialing? I mean, it just seems like if they go through the board, they go through hospital, have you denied any?
Madam Chair, Lisa Trussell with HealthNet, that's a question I'd have to take back. I haven't asked that, if we've ever denied for anything other than our panels were full.
And how much time? It would be nice to know that you've never denied. I would like to know, for those that you don't, for those that you credential, how much time it takes.
Okay.
For each plan. I think that's important for us to know. And in making our decisions.
Madam Chair, if I may, and again, I'm stretching out of my comfort zone, but I think that part of the credentialing, not the contracting, yes, the contracting and credentialing typically happen simultaneously, but they're two separate processes, two different departments. But I think that on the credentialing, that we've got a committee of medical people that go over those as well. And I'm not sure if, I'm pretty sure it's on the credentialing side, not the contracting side. But they don't meet daily, weekly. I'm not sure the frequency of their meeting, but to assume we wanted to look at one, they would be vetted through that group as part of it. So another benefit would be of going to, you know, looking at what the health leadership task force is looking at a regional or effort to credential for the health plans within the guidelines that we have to follow.
But it's important for this committee to know how often you do meet.
Right.
How many are you credentialing each month?
I'll get
or if
you.
It's a quarter, if you don't meet a quarter, if you don't meet for a quarter, then how many are you dealing with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing I would like to point out with this is that also with relationship to the other models that are being discussed of delivering health care, be interesting to see how folding this in with a primary medical home idea might work. So that's something that we haven't thought all the way through, but that we're taking a look at as well.
Okay. Yes, Senator Morrison and Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to clarify that the information that is submitted distinguishes between contracting and actual credentialing, so that we're not looking at duplicated, undifferentiated information.
Well, I thought you wouldn't contract, you wouldn't pay unless you credentialed as a certain provider. So are we talking two different things then?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, as I've indicated before, and I'll get back to you if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that we pay, but it's how we pay. If we don't have a contract with you, you get a different rate than a contracted physician would get. But I do not believe we would deny payment unless the only reason I could think of, and I'll verify it and get back to you, is that it was somebody who had applied that we had said, no, we don't want. I don't know what happens in that circumstance. I still think they would get covered as a non-par provider. But So the difference is not that they won't get paid, it's at what rate, is my understanding, and I will verify that for you.
And we need that clarified, and in the work group, I think that this needs to be clarified, so will you put that down, those that are going to be a part of it, so that we can get this clarified?
And, Madam Chair, Dr. Bates might know the answer to that.
Mr. Baird can answer some
okay.
of that.
Okay, all right, let's go with this panel, and then we'll have a rebuttal.
Okay.
The answer to the question, I believe, is varies from insurer to insurer. It does vary. Most will pay the non-par and satisfy the claim. Others won't, and so it becomes a push and shove. And I don't remember which insurers do and which insurers don't. It varies from policy to policy. So it just varies, Madam Chair. Can I ask a couple of questions?
Yes, please.
When I look at this and think about it, I see this as two different things. One's competency and mm-hmm. credentialing for competency, mm-hmm. and one's financial. And primarily, I think of insurers as a financial situation. We're talking about contracts here that are primarily financial in nature. I don't understand why you're trying to credential somebody on the competency level. That should be done by the state. If they've got their license, it's done. On the other hand, financial arrangements with providers is important, and that's well within what you should be doing. I think that's where I would like to see the focus on this thing of going back and getting more information and that's already been vetted through the state board is redundant. You need to make sure the providers has a valid license that has remained valid, and that should be readily available from the state board of either nursing or the state board of medical. And I don't know if that is or not to you. I don't know. I don't know if they release that information to you quickly and easily. But if they don't, we can work on that with you. So that would be part something I'd like to have a look at in this work group to make sure the state board is going to cooperate with you, because you've got nurse practitioners involved here and others, and make sure those boards are willing to give that information quickly and easily, and that it's up to date, that a physician or nurse practitioner hasn't had a restricted license, doing things they shouldn't do, that you're paying for. That's significant, and you need to have that information quickly and easily. As far as the financial arrangements, that's something you should have a freedom to work out in a reasonable fashion and reasonable time with the providers. I will take issue with one thing. I believe that PPO plans are great and that people should be willing to contract with those within two parties. Restricting a PPO panel because you've got too many of that, I think, is very inappropriate. If a provider is competent and the provider is willing to abide by the rules that are in that PPO for everybody, restricting that panel on that basis is a problem. And the problem is this. You're developing queues and slowing care to patients. It's not. I think this is what's best for a patient, to have a broad panel, everyone agreeing to it, or have a narrow panel where you're going to get in a queue to get through, because there's no real cost savings in the long run if it's a valid service that's needed. So I would ask that the task force look at that, or the task for the work group look at that too, and think long and hard about restricting panels based on you've got too many of that, especially. If they're all willing to abide by those rules, I think they should be in. And the last question I have, the Health Leadership Task Force has been meeting for how long, working on these problems? Is this something that's been going on for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I believe they started meeting in the fall.
Of this year?
Of 08, yes.
Of 08. Madam Chair, I'd offer that I'm glad they're meeting.
Mm-hmm.
These problems have been around for 30 years. Let's see if we can hammer out some issues here. You're not going to solve them all right away, but you can hammer out some issues, I hope.
Madam Chair, Dr. Bates, I would just add on the Healthcare Leadership Task Force. that group emerged at the behest of Oregon businesses, members of, in particular, the Oregon Business Council, who are healthcare experts, and those individuals who so serve on this with a lot of others on committees were asked to figure out, again, ways to, quote, bend the cost curve, pursuant in some regards, but not directly in a direct line relationship to the health fund board stuff, if I can use that inadequate word, all of those issues. And, Mr. Madam Chair, I'd be pleased, I think, well, in fact, I think we did prepare for you a quick summary in two or three pages, your committee staff has it, of the health leadership task force work with four task forces which are poised to produce reports soon on such issues as administrative simplification, cost, evidence-based medicine, and some other, and two other issues that I can't remember at the time. So I would encourage you, and I'll be happy to provide that three-page document again to you, because that is genuine work that's going on. And I would only add this quick additional point. In many cases, the results of that work can be implemented by payers and providers, systems and insurers, without legislative authorization, if I can say that. You don't need legislation to do some of those things. So there's a collaborative effort underway involving hundreds of people. And the time when two people were here, Denise Hansel and John Lee, to present the Milliman report to you, the background for why that report is there is that Health Leadership Task Force. So with that, I'll stop. But there's a linkage there, I think, to these issues.
Well, I think it would be important for Courtney and the work group that we're going to have on this bill also to make sure that the payers bring the recommendations that have come forward so far. We have no idea how our health care reform system is going to become out of this building, and I would hate to not do something hoping that a health authority would take care of it or the health fund board would take care of it, because we're a long ways from knowing what that's going to look like when it comes out of this session. So I'd rather be working on this now also. Okay. All right, let's have Mike Dewey, and then we'll have Jeff Baird or whoever.
Thank you. Mr. Fiskum said good luck. Mike Dewey.
I'm going to echo that, Madam Chair.
Representing ODS. Just want to be on the record that we have issues with this bill. A couple other things. It doesn't explain to us what a clean claim is, and those are issues, and we suggest that ought to be included. The emergency clause is problematic. I understand that we credential within 53 days. We try and do 60. Let me say one other thing. If there is something that goes wrong in a surgery, whatever, and ODS is the insured, and they've credentialed this individual, they've done their due diligence, and arguably they're a deep pocket, and they'll be part of a lawsuit as well, a hospital, the physician. We do get concerned about just carte blanche approving somebody else's credentialing, in the sense that there have been issues in the past, and I look at the nursing board in terms of what has occurred and some issues there. So we don't disagree that there ought to be adequate time frames. We don't have a problem with that. We think we need to be able to do our due diligence also. And with regard to that, in terms of going out and getting the information, it will take us sometimes longer than 30 days just to get the initial information. At the end of the day, what we don't want to have is a situation where we just reject, and that isn't a good way to do it if we have a time frame that doesn't work for us. So we're happy to, again, address this issue in whatever matter you want to do that, Madam Chair.
And it would be, I think, very beneficial to know how many you credential a month or a year or whatever is appropriate, how often you meet,
yes.
and that
well,
kind of
I will tell you, because of the additional business to ODS, I mean, we are very busy in that particular category, but hopefully we're not having a credential because they're already been credentialed. But nonetheless, we'll get you that information.
Yes, Senator Morrison, then Senator Bates.
Oh, you were first.
Go ahead.
I have a hunch it's going to be the same question. I don't know for sure.
Okay.
I wrote down three issues: liability, financial, contracting, and competency. I didn't ask about liability to the previous panel because I thought it would probably be immaterial, but you just brought it back up again. My question in my mind was, I don't know any time, and this may be ignorance from my part, that when a medical malpractice claim has been brought, that it's usually brought against a hospital and a physician, or a physician alone, or a hospital alone. But if you share liability with those two groups, then tort reform obviously is vital for you. Has there actually been cases in the state where insurers have been included in and ultimately not excluded from a medical malpractice case?
Madam Chair and Dr. Bates, I don't know the answer to that. I'm speculating on the liability side, but I would say that initially I wouldn't be surprised that in the first complaint there would be a whole lot of parties as you work through it.
They just throw it to everybody, of course.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I'm just thinking out loud with regard to credentialing. And the if we've credentialed somebody and we've done that due diligence and we haven't done it right, we might be culpable. If we do it on the basis of the Oregon Medical Examiners, whatever they're called, CMS, we might be less culpable in my mind, which might not be a bad thing. But we think it's necessary just to make sure that we feel comfortable with the individuals that are a part of our program.
And I do want to clarify regarding the Board of Nursing issues. Those were the problems that we had with the Board of Nursing were nurses that were probably already credentialed but were then in the nurse monitoring program and should never have been renewed their license and insured.
I appreciate that clarification.
Yeah.
Okay. Quick follow-up.
Yeah.
I'd ask that that be part of the discussion in this group to find out that answer to that question, because that puts an important wrinkle in this thing. If you have to credential based on your potential liability in a medical malpractice case, then you might feel that what the state board does is not adequate, and that adds more cost.
Yeah. And please, Madam Chair, I am not implicating in any negative way the various boards. There are certain procedures insurance companies have under CMS, and we need to follow those procedures. We're not disagreeing that there may be some time frames here we can work with. I do think Mr. Fiskum's discussion about safe harbor and the like are very important here, too.
But it will be information the committee would like to have is how many credentials, how many providers you actually don't credential that the board and hospitals have.
And it might be useful for the administrator to provide us this list, because we're getting a larger list as we're moving forward. And I suspect the next bill will provide some additional lists.
I think it's very important to get feedback from the boards, and I don't know if they need to be a part of the work group or at least on if you're coming up with information, make sure you're including the boards to make sure that what we're coming up with is amenable to whatever they can do within their guidelines. Yes, Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It borders on incredulity that we would have 20 third-party payers credentialing competency of physicians. It is almost incomprehensible to think that that's the structure that we have. And my question would be that would we be consistent with CMS and the federal law and rules if we were to presume that for the purposes of liability, once the state board has certified and hospitals have credentialed, that is sufficient evidence for third-party payers? Would that be consistent with federal law?
That's what we needed.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that's a good question. We would look at that. I suspect there's one interest group that would be involved in that also that's not in this room.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr.
But I won't go any further.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Dewey, so very
Thank
much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Again, I'm setting the direction for a work group. Courtney, you'll need to coordinate with Mr. Shook. And the payers who want to be involved, please let Mr. Shook know, because this is an important issue that I would like to keep pursuing and seeing if we can get some results this session. And that means getting something with amendments within 2 or 3 weeks, because it's the end of April, and we're almost to March. I can't believe this. Okay. With that... Mr. Barrett, yeah.
Madam Chair and committee members, Jeff Baird with Broadway Medical Clinic. Credentialing never occurs until a contract is in place. There's no reason for it. The other thing that has to occur before credentialing is there has to be a license issued from the state. You know, I did a quick Gallup poll with Jake and Marilyn and Joy with the OMA, and we know of no physician that has been credentialed by the medical board that has been rejected by a plan, other than for economic credentialing reasons, which is a way to exclude the panel.
We would need to then get that information to on nurse practitioners.
That's reasonable.
All right, thank you very much. All right, no further questions. All right, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 507 and open up our public hearing. I close the public hearing on 507 and open a public hearing on 508. Dr. Lace.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 508 again requires health insurers to request refunds from providers within 12 months of date of payment to provider and allow 6 months for payment from provider.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Lake. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. I'm a practicing pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. In the doing business, the business of doing medicine, we contract with insurers, and it happens where an insurance company can come back 2 years, 3 years later, and say, oh, by the way, we paid you erroneously. You owe us money. By that time, the patient has either changed insurance company, gone to something else, and we have no recourse, and usually we have to end up writing that off or actually send them back a check, or they take out money on future payments. So we have no level playing ground, if you will. We can't bill for a service usually after a year that we signed a contract. So we would ask that the insurance companies follow the same rules, which is you can't come back 2 years later, 3 years later, which has happened, and actually bill, get money back from the provider at that point. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, it does happen. I wish it didn't happen, but it does happen, and that's one of the reasons why we're addressing this. So we just like to have the same rules apply. The other thing is on this is that we would like to, if there is a request for a refund, oftentimes, as the insurance companies do, they don't have what we call prompt payment, and so we'd like to extend that ability for us to pay back up to 6 months. Those are basically the two, the big elements of this bill. Office administrators can give you a little more detail on it because they live and die by that every day, but it happens all the time. I wish it didn't, but it does. So.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And let's just is it Jake, and I still feeling, and Brian Parrott and Mary Happold Latham. Okay.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jake Thielen. I'm the administrator at Orthopedic Fracture Clinic in Portland, Oregon. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. I do have some written testimony. Unfortunately, it's somewhere in the computer crash of the OMA, so you'll get that at another date, so I'll kind of paraphrase here. Again, what we're looking for here is a level playing field with insurance companies. And many times in contracts, they say we have 60 to 90 days. At the outset, it's 1 year to submit from bills from the date that we see patients, and they have no problem with coming back 2 and 3 years later and saying, by the way, we overpaid you, we mispaid you, you need to refund us this money, and then you can go after the patient for it. I have actually something here, a copy of a letter. It's actually where insurance companies coming back 28 months later and saying, we didn't pay you according to contract, we want this money, and if we don't get it, we're taking it away from future payments in the next 30 days, and then you can go bill the patient for those amounts. We want to be able to you know, run a business and have things be an effective timeline, and we think that a year is more than enough for an insurance company to go through and say, yeah, there was an error, and then to give us the opportunity to respond to that and say, yes, you know, yes, there was an error, here's your money back, or no, this wasn't, here's our records, and this shows why we shouldn't be refunding you that without the penalty of, if you don't do it in 30 days, we're pulling that from a future payment.
And you nicely did not put the health plan that did
this. No, I blocked out the patient's name in the
health
plan.
So we don't know right. Which one of you out there did this.
I wasn't trying to pick on anybody.
Yeah, this happens all the time.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Heppold Latham, and I'm currently working as a medical group consultant and worked with medical groups as administrator over the past 15 years. In the Portland area, and I submitted a page and a half of written testimony. In the Portland area and throughout the Pacific Northwest, most of the services provided by physicians are paid for based on agreed-upon contracts between health plans and the physician. These contracts control everything from the amount the physician is paid for a particular service to minute details on how the health plan expects the physician to run their business. Health plan contracts are generally offered as boilerplate contracts with little opportunity for the physician to negotiate meaningful changes. Health plan contracts all require physicians to file a claim for services within a given time period. This period varies from as little as 90 days to as long as a year. Health plans use these claim filing deadlines as reason to deny payment to physicians if the time frame is not met. When a payment is received for services provided, the physician assumes that all the health plan's payment criteria have been met and the health plan has correct and adequate information to make payment to that physician. Unfortunately, it is not uncommon for health plans to make errors in adjudicating claims. These are often due to coordination of benefits issues when the patient has not provided either the physician or the health plan with information regarding a secondary insurance coverage. As a result, the health plan that paid the physician as the primary payer should have really been the secondary payer. This plan then requests a refund from the physician. If the plan does not make this request in a timely manner, once the physician refunds the plan that incorrectly paid as primary, the physician has to rebill the health plan that should have been primary. If this is past the timely filing deadline, the physician may be unable to pursue payment from either the primary plan or the patient. This can result in financial losses for the physician while the health plan is able to recoup their monies. Requests for a refund of an overpayment can also be for a number of other less straightforward reasons. These reasons are ones that the physician may disagree with and may need time to research and dispute. Short time frames for overpayment recovery do not allow the physician adequate time to dispute the request. Health plans are also becoming more aggressive in their attempts to recoup from physicians what they consider to be overpayments. Many have hired third parties to comb through years and years worth of claims data in order to recover what they consider to be overpayments. Physician practices have been faced with requests for refunds from these third parties for services provided 2 or 3 years prior. The third parties undoubtedly receive a percentage of everything that they are able to collect in overpayment recovery. Some of these third parties are so aggressive, physician practices feel like they're being harassed. Needless to say, these requests for refunds are very expensive and time-consuming for the physician staff to research and determine if a refund is indeed in order. Although most plans currently allow the physician practice at least 30 days to refund an overpayment, some plans have now decided they will do an automatic recoupment of an overpayment with no notice to the physician at all. An automatic recoupment is when the health plan deducts the overpayment amount from a subsequent payment to the physician. This practice is often not described in the health plan contract. The recoupment can occur because the health plan merely reduces the amount it pays on another patient's account. This is an accounting nightmare for the physician practice when it tries to reconcile payments posted to a patient's account to the amount deposited in the bank. The physician has absolutely no recourse in the process and no ability to dispute the request from the health plan. Automatic recoupments of potential overpayments are a terrible business practice on the part of the health plan and make for poor working relationships between the health plan and the physicians. Based on my experience, health plans do not audit their payments to physicians on a regular basis, and their business insurance processes seem disorganized. Health plans impose strict time-related requirements for physicians to file claims for payment for services. It seems reasonable that health plans should be limited to equally strict requirements for recover of overpayments as the Senate Bill 508 would provide.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I assume there are underpayments as well as overpayments, and my question is, in the event of an underpayment, how long does it take you to get paid?
Well, I actually have a lot of experience with that as the OMA. I've worked on the OMA Finance Committee regarding that, and trying to collect, first of all, trying to even identify underpayments is very challenging, but once you are able to collect an underpayment, it is also very challenging to collect from the health plan because oftentimes they will try to argue it's a timely filing issue when it's really not. But collecting underpayments is also very difficult.
And in addition, there is a time frame that...
And introduce yourself again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jake Thielen from Orthopedic and Fracture. There's a time frame, too. If we receive an underpayment from the insurance company, if we don't respond to that back to them within usually 60 or 90 days, they'll tell us, sorry, you can't get that money back. And it depends upon some contracts. You can go up to a year, but there's a lot of them out there that are 60 and 90 days.
So, Madam Chair, it does not work both ways in the same way?
No, it does not.
Interesting.
That's what we're asking for, is that it work the same both ways.
Yes,
Madam Chair, thank you. If you don't think that our health care system is insane, you've been asleep this morning. And both sides of this are locked into something they really both want to get out of. There's not good people and bad people. There's not insurers aren't bad, mm-hmm. Doctors aren't good. The things evolved over the last 30 or 40 years, and it's just sort of a nightmare we're trying to get both sides back out of. This one, when I read this one, this is much more straightforward. This is what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Going back 2-3 years on claims is crazy, and needs that needs to end. Okay, but we have physicians who are also guilty. I have people in my 32-man group who are holding bills from hospitals they have not submitted. They are now 9 months old. They have not. We asked them to turn the claim in so we can bill the insurance company, and a couple of these guys. Well, I'll get around to it. I'll get my discharge summary done. I'll get my work done, so there's some fault on both sides here, Madam Chair. That's why I want to understand that. We've got physicians who don't do their paperwork, don't get things in a timely basis to the insurers, and it's unfair to them too. But I do think a 12-month limit on both sides is appropriate. If you don't turn that claim in 12 months, I'm sorry, the insurers have a right to say we're not going to pay you, and they shouldn't. And I would prefer that physicians be a little more competent in getting that done, but having a gun at their head helps me sometimes when I have people I supervise to make them get the job done. On the other hand, what's good for the goose is good for the gander here. Let's get this cleaned up. This looks like a pretty straightforward bill, but I'd like to hear what the other side has to say.
Mr. Parrott, do you wish to say anything?
Thank you, Chairman. I'll just add a couple of things. First of all, this is modeled after Washington law. It's very similar. The time frames are what is currently in Washington. This is not uncommon in states. So this isn't something new to Oregon. It's leveling the playing field. Secondly, some insurance companies by contract do limit the time, but it's very rare. One of the ways they have done this is they've made it reciprocal, and they've just said, you know, if we have 6 months, then you have 6 months. But that is extremely rare. We don't see that very often.
I like 6 months. 6 months would help me. I got some doctors.
All right, any other questions? Thank you. Let's bring up Dave Fiskum, Lisa Tressel, Mike Dewey, and Kim Wirtz.
Yes, I know. We aren't the bad guys all the way through. I got two doctors.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm still Lisa Tressel with HealthNet Health Plans, and here in opposition to Senate Bill 508. And one of the details that I couldn't get by this morning is that what we're looking for is consistency, as they are, but they're looking at consistency with us and them, which is not a bad thing. But we're also looking at consistency with some of our other contracts, like Medicare and
in Oregon, that's the main one we use. And I'm not sure of the time limit on Medicare. And so for consistency, that's one of the things that we wanted to check on so that you don't have to have separate systems versus government payer or commercial. So with that, I'll stop talking.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm still Kim Wirtz with Regents. And Regents adopted a practice as the Washington law changed to create a consistency in our contract administration. And so we do limit our overpayment recovery to a 12-month time period. With regards to the six-month repayment, I think Regents is willing to work with providers in that particular vein to make sure that it's not damaging to them. We try to reach out and work. Providers are pretty important to us. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Dave or to Mike. Sorry.
I could be Dave, but I might not. Be. Dave wouldn't like it. Yeah. Waxes poetically. Mike Dewey, ODS, and I apologize. I've been up here now three times to oppose bills. I don't necessarily like to do that. This is, again, a complicated area, albeit I sure like this stuff better than the rental network, which I'm still trying to figure out what that's all about, but nonetheless, I digress. We're happy to have the conversation about equality here. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I'm not sure why a request for refund paid sooner than 6 months can't be provided by us. I don't understand that portion of it. It does take a while to figure out if there is an overpayment. It is complex. I don't know if it's insane, but there is some methodicalness to all of this. I'm not sure, Madam Chair, how you want to deal with this bill. We're happy to work with our, if you will, people that are certified smart in this area that do this on a daily basis. At the end of the day, what we don't want to do is add additional administrative costs. And sometimes we lose sight of that. And quite frankly, we're all trying to figure out a way to find some cost savings and controls. And so far, we haven't been very successful. And I don't want to pass, in my mind, bills that have some unintended consequences of increasing our cost internally, new websites, new software that unfortunately have to be passed on to the commercial payer. So with that, I will stop.
I had a visit with my surgeon the other day, or my last month or whenever, and he said, if you can do one thing, just cut down all of the paperwork that we have to do regarding billing. He's one physician and I think two LPNs, and then I think he said he had three people doing the billing in his office. So you know, I know what would be more administrative work for you. It's actually huge amount at the provider level. So,
and the conundrum is the healthcare industry is growing a bit compared to the rest of the economy, but that can't happen if we have what Regents is starting to see, and we're going to talk to ODS about the grace periods and when people are paying premiums and the like.
But a surgeon working with 20 plans, I can understand why he needs to have three people.
Okay, yes.
Just one more comment, if I could. And when this work group looks at this, I'd ask them to look at something that was brought up here that's pretty important. My memory of this, and I could be wrong, is that we have control of the Medicaid look back. We can limit that 12 months. I think it's a state priority. Not priority, but it's within the province of the state to do that. And commercial plans, I'm not too sure about Medicare. I think Medicare Advantage plans we probably have some control over. But Medicare may have different federal requirements for how far back they can go back and look at claims. So you may want to look at that pretty carefully. And we may be blocked there from doing anything. And that will put a little more complexity into the discussion. But that was the one I worry about that we may not be able to do anything about. And we would understand that.
And I do think this committee can solve the aggregate farmer conflict. I think that this is a good committee to do that. So.
Yeah. Senator Morse and I will work on that one. So.
This is easier than that one.
All right. Thank you very much. And it looks like Dave Fiskum just isn't coming back. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this? All right. Courtney, another work group for this issue, same players, so you may be dealing with them all. Mr. Parrott, if you could check out that Medicare issue, that would be important for the committee to know before you come up with any amendments. If there's no further, and work with Mr. Shook on when these meetings are happening and who is in attendance, that's extremely important for us to know. Come up to the podium, Courtney.
Just to make sure that.
Introduce yourself for the.
Courtney Dresser, OMA. Just to make sure that we do get everybody that wants to be part of the work group that they do go through, that this go through him.
Yes. Definitely.
Not me.
Yes.
But well, we can work on a timeline.
Right. Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. All right. If there's no further discussion, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 508, and we are adjourned.
No, we're not.
Oh, wait. I reopen.
Yeah.
I reopen. Didn't mean to adjourn. We have committee bills.
We'll go into work session. We'll do them.
And, yes, I'd like to open a work session to introduce committee bills.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1895, dated 2909, LC 3052, dated 22309, LC 3211, dated 21609. I think that's it.
No.
Oh, one more. Oh, yeah. And LC 3211. No, that's a dash one.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's it.
That's how it is. That's how it's listed.
Dash one be introduced as committee bills.
All right. Senator Cruz has moved that we introduce LC 3211-1, 3211. 3052 and 1895 as possible as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, it's about time we saw some tort reform in some committee in this bill.
Okay.
We can keep that
aside. If I see no opposition, so ordered. I close the work session on introduction of committee bills, and we are adjourned.